Right, well, I'd like to welcome today to our interview Natasha Bhatia. Welcome, Natasha.
Hello, Elaine. Thank you.
I met Natasha when I was talking to a group of people about having looking at new career opportunities. And I met Natasha, and it was just one of those moments where we kind of knew that we would speak with each other at some point in the future, and we didn't know why. And it turned out that Natasha had actually had ME and had a really, quite a difficult journey with it. So I've invited her along today because she has got an amazing story to tell. And Natasha was diagnosed after suffering for quite a long time with ME, so she's going to share that with us today. And her journey really began in sort of 1991, and we're really looking at something like a 10-year window, which for a young person, I think she was 16 when you first were ill, Natasha, is that right?
That's when it really started, yes, 16.
So, quite a long journey for you. But the exciting thing is that you're about to be married in about 3 weeks' time.
Three weeks tomorrow, yes.
So a really inspirational story to know that, you've got your life back. And I know that with all what we've discussed, that you've really got so much to look forward to now. And also, ME has also helped you find your career, hasn't it?
Yes, so, definitely.
Okay, so I just want to start really then. So tell us about when you first became ill, Natasha. What was happening for you?
Okay. Well, I mean, I was 14, 15, 16, and, going through the usual changes within a female body. So it was a little bit difficult to understand what was okay, what was normal and what wasn't. But I realised that I started getting far more infections and far more viruses than my friends at school. And that went on for a couple of years, and went backwards and forwards to the doctor, and he sort of said, it's fine, we just need to supplement you and you'll be okay. Then what happened is, at the age of 16, I was diagnosed with glandular fever, and I had a big crash, and my body just completely gave up, and I was sort of, bedridden for a few months off school and things like that. And I think that was when we thought this was the reason why I'd been poorly for a couple of years previously. We thought that the glandular fever was the answer to why I wasn't well.
Yes.
But actually, we didn't realise that was the beginning of an even more difficult journey. But so it was at the age of 16, really, after glandular fever, that everything started to sort of go even more downhill. It wasn't until I was 21 that I was at work and I just fell down to the floor. That's when doctors started to take it more seriously, and I was diagnosed with ME when I was 21. That was in 1996.
That's quite shocking, really, isn't it, to actually literally collapse with this, that you don't know what's going on in your body. So just before we sort of look at that stage, tell us, you've mentioned a few of the symptoms that you had before your crash. What were you doing to kind of deal with how you were feeling in those years before you realised, before you ended up with glandular fever?
Well, question. It was a very difficult few years, because you're desperately trying to get yourself strong all the time, but you're battling with viruses and infections that are out of your control.
Yeah.
As soon as you're sort of recovering from one bout of antibiotics and one awful virus, you're just, you feel like you've got about a day in your life before you go down with something else. So, I mean, emotionally, it was a very difficult time for me. I was obviously a young woman dealing with all sorts of difficult things going on in the body anyway, and I found it very, very difficult, very, very difficult. It was a very emotional time. I remember I did spend a lot of my time in tears, to be honest with you, because I just wanted somebody to help me. I knew that it wasn't normal how I was feeling, and yet everybody was telling me that there was nothing that they could do. It was a very frustrating time.
What was the response in the family, Natasha, when you were going through this stage?
Family, obviously a lot of worry, but I can honestly say that my parents and their support, I mean, I would not be where I am today if it wasn't for that. They were absolutely fantastic. They, of course, did everything that they could, or that they knew that they could, marching me backwards and forwards to the GP, which obviously, as we realise now, is not necessarily the right path. But we'll get onto that, maybe. But marching me backwards and forwards to the GP, my dad being from India, he did a lot of research and contacted a lot of people in India trying to find answers. But of course, not being in India at the time, it was very difficult to give diagnosis over the phone. My mum spent a lot of time researching, trying to find out what on earth was wrong with me. I mean, I think they both used to lie awake at night, including myself, thinking that maybe they weren't going to find me alive in the morning. That sounds very dark. But when you know that you're ill and somebody's not telling you why you're ill or what is happening, you know, you imagine all sorts of things. And I think that's the hardest thing to come to terms with before you're diagnosed, is the not knowing. You know, we can deal with anything in life once we have the name, have something that we can actually tangibly hold on to and research. But when we don't have an official diagnosis, I think it's really very, very, very difficult.
That's right. And it's knowing as well the impact it's having on those people that love you is tough, isn't it, too, to sort of deal with. You can see the worry in their eyes, can't you?
Very tough. Very tough. I mean, and I can honestly say that only really now that I'm out of the dark place that I can see how much worry and how much angst and how much anxiety and how much trauma my parents and my brother and my friends at the time actually went through. I mean, when you're poorly, you can't really see that, but it is very difficult for people around you. Very, very difficult. Very, very difficult. And I'm sure if you were to talk to my mother today, she would still burst into tears about it all.
Exactly. Also, you have a brother, and that's one other thing, isn't it, that the siblings' lives get so badly affected when there's one person very, you know, very ill in a family.
They do. They absolutely do. And I've been on a bit of a journey with my brother, and we got to a point a few years ago when I sort of broke down and I said to him, I'm just so, so sorry for everything that happened, that you were pushed to the side. And you know, I was the focus for many, many years. And, you know, I hope you know that I didn't mean for that to happen. And, you know, and we are rebuilding our relationship, but it doesn't happen overnight. It is happening slowly but surely, but it does take time, because they're also in a very strange position. You know, they see their sister, somebody that they love, in pain, but yet they can't do anything about it. And also being a man, wanting to step in and take control and make it okay, and he wasn't able to do that. So it put him in a very awkward situation as well, and all it did was really alienate us from each other. So it was difficult.
How can impact so many other, you know, it's like ripples in a pond, isn't it? You know, that their lives are equally affected. And, you know, we talk about sibling rivalry, but when you've got all your parents' attention being lavished on the person that's ill, they, you know, there must be some resentments and things going on for people in families. And we hear that all the time. Yeah. So it's great to hear that you're rebuilding that relationship, because it wasn't your fault, of course. But, you know, nonetheless, people do get affected by it.
Yeah. Definitely. But I believe that everything can be rebuilt. I think the most important thing is to be honest and acknowledge that there has been a problem.
Yeah.
And get it out on the table. Yeah. And, you know, I said that I was sorry to my brother, because I am sorry to him for what he went through, because it wasn't fair for him. But, you know, and he accepted that, and we're trying to make it right. So I think, you know, I'm positive about that. I think we can do it.
That's great. So how did this actually affect this illness? It was quite a long period for you. How did this affect your life and work?
Okay. Well, there wasn't any work, basically. When I collapsed at the age of 21, before that I tried to hold down a job, but I wasn't able to, because I kept getting sick and not really understanding why. So at the age of 21, I had to give up my job, and I didn't work again for years, because I had 4 years where I was completely unable to work or study or anything. I moved back to my folks, and they basically nursed me. And, you know, during that, those 4 years, from the age of 21 to sort of 24, 25, it's a very crucial time, I think, in your early 20s as a woman, in sort of finding out who you are, where you want to be, where you're going. So I found that really, really hard. I lost the majority of my friends as well, which was very difficult, because at that age as well, I don't think people really understand what's happening, or they don't want to understand what's happening. So yeah, it was a very, very difficult time. So for quite a few years, I wasn't able to do anything. I did have a life, but very occasionally. I was able to leave the house, but again, very occasionally. It was leaving the house usually to see a Reiki practitioner, or to see my ME specialist, or to go for a walk with my mum in the park, or, you know, just to do very sort of simple things. But it was all about recovery. It wasn't about anything else, to be honest with you, for quite a long time.
It dominates the whole sort of your whole waking life, doesn't it, at a certain stage in your recovery process?
Every minute of the day is dominated. Every minute of the day, it's all you can think about, and it's all you can hope for. You know, it's a lot of pressure. You know, I must get better. I will get better, or will I get better? You know, you have so many doubts and wonders whether you are going to make it. You know, I was told I'd be in a wheelchair when I was 25. I'm 33 now, and obviously there is not a wheelchair in sight, and hopefully there will never be one. But I always have that fear, and I still do have that fear, that if I don't look after myself still, that I'm going to crash again. And that's hard, and that's on a daily basis.
And it is another stage of recovery, and we've talked about this in the past. You know, you really have got your life back on track, sort of, you know, 90%, but there's still just that last little bit to release around the fear factor of going back there, and it's absolutely normal. And we hear it all the time, and that phase lasts for different periods of time for different people, yeah. Natasha. So I think it's really helpful that you've shared that with others. Yeah. What do you actually believe triggered your illness?
That's a good question, and I have thought about this many times. I don't know whether, glandular fever was definitely the main trigger in my absolute collapse, you know, my entire body collapsing. So that virus was the main trigger. Now, I do believe that I wasn't well before that, so that I don't know the actual triggers before. I believe that there could have been, you know, huge emotional triggers with, you know, working out who I was, and I don't know, many things that go along with sort of being mixed race and having lots of difficulties growing up. I don't know. I've thought about it many times, but I do believe health-wise that glandular fever for me was what set me on that awful path.
So,
if
so
that makes sense, yeah.
There, some emotional stuff going on that would have, you know, caused an element of stress in the system,
and
which kind of left you open for those viruses and things to attack, really.
Exactly. I think that's exactly what happened. I mean, obviously, I haven't got any confirmation, but I believe that I did have a sort of slightly difficult sort of a few years before that, and emotionally, and yes, of course, as we know, any emotional stress, you know, leads to the immune system falling, and, you know, your body is just so more vulnerable. So, yes, I think definitely that's exactly what happened.
And in terms of you as a person, you know, I know we've talked about this, you know, those elements of perfectionism in there, liking to be in control, would you say that those things were part of you, part of your sort of makeup?
Yes, definitely. Anyone that knows me would just laugh. Yes, definitely. I've never thought of myself until only really the last year or so as somebody that, you know, do I have to be in control of everything? I never thought that that's who I was, but I am a perfectionist, and I suppose that within that there is an element of having to be in control if you want everything to be perfect all the time. I don't know where it comes from, whether I was born like that, or whether, you know, having an illness like this means that you start to see the world slightly differently, and you start to see your life slightly differently. I don't know. I think it's probably a mixture of the two.
Yeah.
And I do battle with dealing with that, you know, and because I still put a lot of pressure on myself having to have everything so perfect. So it is something that I need to deal with, and I still need to address that. Like we said, you know, nothing happens that quickly, and that it takes time. Recovery is not going to be overnight. It's probably a journey that I'll have now for the rest of my life.
Good news is that you're aware of those, that, you know, the perfectionism and the control aspect, and that if they're just the last little bits that are still causing you a few problems, then it's just a case of working through them, and it's going to take as long as it takes. But you know, just to reassure you, we do see I was the world's worst, Natasha, and I was able to let go of all that. So you know, just to give you hope there.
Good.
So in terms of relapses, yes. You know, nobody has been through this journey without having lots of them. What do you think was a major cause for you of those relapses, when you kind of, you know, you get up that slippery pole, you feel a bit better and you're able to do more, and then suddenly there's that crash again?
Okay. The first one was probably, it sounds awful, but I fell in love for the first time, and, you know, alongside falling in love, is you know, it can be obviously a very emotional time, and I was with somebody that wanted to look after me when we realized that I wasn't well. And I think that the fact that relationship wasn't working out just broke my heart, and it did lead to an absolute crash for me. I think, you know, I wasn't well anyway, but the emotional sort of anxiety and stress, and my heart felt like it was really breaking, you know, that did lead to the relapse, unfortunately.
We've spoken about support dynamics.
Yes.
You know, you said your mum and dad were fantastic, they were researching, they were helping you, they were doing whatever they could, and then there you were with this relapse, living with somebody that you loved. However, it wasn't a healthy support relationship, was it?
No, it wasn't. But I didn't realise that at the time, of course. He, you know, he is probably to this day still one of the most wonderful men I've ever known in my life, and I can say that with my hand on my heart. But the problem is that he had a lot of his own problems and a lot of his own emotional anxieties that he was trying to deal with. And we were trying to have a relationship, and it wasn't working. And I broke down to my father one day, and he's a very wise man, and he said to me very simply, and I completely understood what he meant at that time. He said, "Look, Natasha, you know, there's a lot of love there, but at the end of the day, how can a broken branch support another broken branch? You know, it's just not going to happen. One day, you're just both going to fall." And I sort of looked at him and realised that that's exactly what we were trying to do. We were two people that wanted desperately for it to work, but we both needed too much from each other, and we couldn't give it to each other. So, you know, I think it's so difficult to find the right dynamics, I think, when one person is poorly, or two people. It's just very, very difficult. I don't know if that makes any sense to you.
No, completely. You know, there is this element that, you know, get their own needs met by caring for another person. It distracts them from their own things that they need to deal with, or sometimes it just gives them a sense of fulfilment. Yeah. And so they invest a lot of time in caring for that person. And of course, then there's always a little worry there. If this person gets better, will they still need me or want me?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, that somebody that needs to do that can only need to do that for so long before they crash themselves. You know, it's inevitable, I think, that it's going to happen. And yeah, it's very difficult. It's very difficult, and every two people, I'm sure, are very different, and every relationship is very different. But it's a very complex thing.
Definitely. So, in terms of recovery, then,
yes,
what are the things that you did? So, you know, imagine we've got people listening today that are, you know, they're hanging on your every word. What were the things that really worked for you?
Okay, I mean, the first thing that happened for me was that I actually, my parents put me in touch with an ME specialist. He's no longer working in the UK. He's in Canada now, so I can't give any of those details. But I think just having somebody that that can just, you know, accept that you're not well. You know, when he said to me, you poor girl, you know, what have you been going through? That in itself was a turning point for me, that somebody was there just to accept that. So however that is in your life, to just have somebody that can just say, you know, I'm so sorry that you're having to feel like this. I think that's really important, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
That was very important for me. I actually believe very much in Reiki, which is, I don't know if it's something you've come across before, but it's a universal life force energy healing system, and it came into my life by chance. I mean, my father sort of knew somebody who practiced it and was recommended to me, and my mum said, you know, she can't travel very far, and it just so happened, as if by magic, that she actually lived three doors away from my parents, can you believe? So I was able to actually get up and walk across to see her. So I started to have spiritual healing every week. Now, obviously, it might not be everyone's thing, but I think within that, it's just a time that you're completely switched off. Either you're meditating or you're with somebody that believes that they can help you. And that positive hour for me every week was so powerful, and it became something that I really looked forward to. So I started to build up a little bit of a routine in my life of things that were really lovely for me to do. If that makes sense.
Yes, yes.
And so that was very important for me. Obviously surrounding myself with people that I trusted, and that I knew understood me, or were trying to understand me at least. That was really important. My diet was very, very important. I had to completely change my diet, obviously. I can't think.
So we've got the Reiki. We've got the ME specialist that believed in you and had empathy for you.
Yes.
And we've also got some nutritional changes going on here. So, you know, as we always say, there's no one thing for this, is there? It is a multifaceted approach.
Definitely.
What kind of nutritional changes did you make, Natasha?
Sorry, say that again?
What kind of things did you change in your diet?
Right, okay. I changed quite a lot, actually. I cut out my digestive system was basically non-existent. I didn't really have a digestive system. You know, I had something that was called a leaky gut.
Yes.
So everything I was putting into my body was going straight back into my bloodstream, which meant I had to be incredibly strict on what was going in, because I couldn't afford for any further toxins to be floating around in my blood. So I cut out everything. I mean, it's probably better tell you what I did eat rather than what I didn't eat, because otherwise we might be here until midnight. I lived on a lot of brown rice, a lot of vegetables, fresh vegetables, steamed mainly. Lentils was very good for me. My dad, obviously being Indian and being very good to cook, he was able to cook lentils for me. Again, very minimal chili. I think that's something to be very, very careful with. A lot of water. I mean, I had to cut out completely, obviously, all the caffeine, because that's just absolutely no good for anybody who's struggling in that way. Water and herbal teas, pretty much, and that was about it, to be honest with you. I lived on that diet for quite a long time.
But it's changed my diet.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I know that now, if I do not look after myself, I mean, of course, you know, now I'm in a position where I don't have to be that strict all the time. But if I don't look after myself for a couple of days, I know that I have to be careful, because my stomach will suffer, and then my head will suffer, and I'll start to get headaches, and then one thing will lead to another. And before I know it, within a week, I could be feeling really poorly again. So I think we shouldn't underestimate the power of our diet. You know, every single thing that goes into our mouth, we should be really, considering what that is, definitely.
And the tip, you're not wishing, of course, as I found when I was ill, was that, you know, sometimes you eat junk food because you feel pretty horrible and you just want something to make you feel a little bit better. And so in the early days I was ill, I was definitely eating all the wrong things, which made things 100 times worse. So it was a real turning point when I got, you know, handle on eating the right foods.
Yes,
without a doubt.
Definitely. It's very difficult because, of course, you just want you want to be comforted because you feel so poorly and you feel so alone. And food is a, as we all know, is a great way of doing that sometimes. So, and still now as well, you know, there's certain little treats that I have that I know if I start to feel a little bit down, that I know that I could probably have. For example, I can have a little bit of dark organic chocolate now and again. You know, I know that, you know, and I think it's important to have these little treats in your life to remember that they're there so you don't go for something completely outrageously wrong.
Right. In terms of when you got back to work, because you did, didn't you? You went back into kind of the corporate world once you were well. I know that also wasn't the right path for you. And tell us what happened around that and how the creativity came into your life and changed everything.
Okay, well, actually, the first thing that I did do when I was better, you know, on the road to getting better and feeling that I was strong enough to do something, was my parents said to me when I had those 4 or 5 years at their house recovering, what is it that you want to do with your life? What is it that you really want to do? And I said, I want to be an artist, and I didn't really know where this was coming from, so. And they said, okay, then we will support you in whatever you want to do. So the first thing I actually did, Elaine, was I went to and I applied for a foundation course in London at an art college, and I got accepted. So I did that, and then I went on to do a degree. So that was actually 4 years of my life. I didn't actually get into the corporate world again until after that. And the reason why I got into the corporate world, I think, was because I was scared of not being able to fulfill my dreams of becoming an artist, I think, and I was trying to find something that I knew I could do and that would just sort of fill my time and make me feel that I was alive, not knowing that was actually all the wrong reasons to make a decision. But obviously I realised that later. So I started working for a corporate beauty company, and before I knew it, I was just in an absolute state again, on the path to having another relapse last year.
That's what happens. The body is so powerful, isn't it, at giving us messages when we're on and off the right track.
Yes, definitely. And I knew it. I knew it all along. I knew it every day.
Yeah.
I was so frightened of... I think when you've had an illness like this, so correct me if I'm wrong, things that you want to do in life become so important.
Yes.
Because you realise you've got another chance, another opportunity, and you don't want to mess them up, you know, you don't want to make any mistakes. And the pressure then, again, coupled with the fact that I'm a perfectionist, meant that I just couldn't cope with that anxiety of throwing myself into the art world, trying to find out who I was as an artist. It was just too much. I was just so happy, I think, at that time, being able to get up and go to work 3 days a week. Now, I was only working 3 days a week, remember. I wasn't able to still hold down a full-time job.
Yeah.
But, though, you know, 3 days a week was more than enough for me in that kind of environment. I think I might have been able to hold down a full-time job if I was doing something different.
Yeah.
I think that's a very important thing to consider as well. You know, what you are doing every day of your life, you know, every hour of that day is important. It's very, very important. And you're right, my mind was slowly crashing because it was unhappy. And my body, of course, was the way that it really showed that.
Yeah.
In the fact that I started to get poorly again, and I started to get anxious, and I started to get a lot of headaches, and my, you know, I started to catch everything again that was there every month around the time of my cycle. You know, I used to get an infection, and I started to go on antibiotics again. And I knew the signs, and I knew that I had to do something about it. So I left.
I think the fact that it's not about you know, people say, you know, it's not about how many hours you're out doing something. It's whether it's the right thing or the wrong thing, isn't it? Because, you know, 3 days a week doing the wrong thing will have the same impact of, you know, it'll have a much worse impact than if you're doing 5 days a week doing something that you absolutely love. You know, you're going to keep your energy up. I mean, and compare how you felt at university to how you felt in that corporate world only doing 3 days. And
comparison,
very different, I would say.
And I had a... I had another 4 years when I was at university to be well. And, you know, in the corporate world, when I went back to university, I'd only just really got out of the dark place. And still I felt $1 million compared to how I felt the last few years of my life.
Yeah, so, that's the right track, because I've seen your artwork, and let me tell you, we're going to put some on the site because it is absolutely stunning. And if there's anything you should be doing in this world and contributing your gifts and talents, it's in art, because it's absolutely spectacular. So, I was bowled over when I saw your portfolio. So if Emmy has led you to do the sort of creative work you do, then... certainly it's been a gift to the world. I don't know how you feel about that.
Definitely. No, I do feel that I honestly wouldn't change my journey now, because I've got to a place where I realise I understand myself on such a different level. And you're right, I wouldn't be on this path to finding out who I am as an artist if it wasn't for that. You know, one of the first things I did at university, and I didn't even realise it was that important, was I had to try and visualise my illness. You know, I had to get it out. And, you know, that was so therapeutic. I mean, that's probably the best medicine that I've ever had. You know, talking about what I did to recover, you know, I think that's probably up there in my top three, is finding another way to express myself and get it out of my body and out of my mind, because it becomes such a big thing, doesn't it, when we keep it all inside.
Yeah.
That it was very powerful, very powerful for me. And I definitely want to work with that idea more. You know, and a lot of my work is about visualizing emotion, visualizing things that we can't see. And again, I think that has a strong link to the illness. You know, the illness is something that we can't see, but yet we so desperately want it to be visualised all the time, don't we? Because we want everybody to see what it is that we're feeling. So that's a big part of my life, definitely. Still,
I completely when you start talking about this, and I know that we're planning at some point to do an exhibition so that we can get your work. In conjunction with an ME recovery program that we're going to run, so and certainly get that up on the wall so people can see how it really is therapeutic and how it was a catalyst for your recovery.
Definitely. And I think for anybody, I think not just for me, I had the burning desire to be an artist, to be a creative, but I think that it's a fantastic thing for everybody to think about. Because it's just another tool, or it's just another way of expressing yourself, and that's so important. So, you know, definitely, there's a lot of potential there for all of us.
I was going to ask you that. What advice would you give to somebody? You know, they're at home, they're feeling as wretched as you did all those years ago. I mean, if you look back on that period now, and you had the hindsight and the benefit of knowing your journey, what advice would you give those people now that are listening to this?
Okay, well, I'm obviously very aware that stimulating yourselves with television and sound is not always something that we want to do or we can do. So I think being quiet and having a sketchbook and having a pencil or having a pen or whatever it is that you feel comfortable with. And, you know, whether it's drawing, whether it's writing notes or something, it's just getting something down on paper. I think it's very important, and I think sitting quietly is a very powerful thing. I think sometimes we think we need to be doing something all the time. You know, we need to have some kind of sound in our life all the time, or some kind of something visual, but we don't. We've got everything we need inside of us, I believe, and that we just need to try and find a way of actually just getting that out on paper, because it's really comforting. I mean, I don't know how many people keep diaries and sort of, you know, and visual diaries and things like that, but I think it's really important, really important. I don't know how you feel about that. But
on our program, we encourage people to keep a journal and write every single day, and just show up at the page and get it out of their head. And I think what is lovely is the fact that what you've introduced into that is that it doesn't all have to be written, does it? It can be drawn. It can be done in a more creative way, whatever works for that individual. And it is amazing how many artists that come out of the SME journey, people do tap in and find a creativity. I know one of the first things that helped me, and I've just remembered it, was that I actually went to a creative writing course. That was one of the first things I did when I was, when I just was coming, you know, well enough to go out.
Yes.
And yes. Just to go and do the kind of writing that I used to do when I was a child, you know, poetry. Things yes. that I'd lost contact with. And, you know, I've always loved poetry, and that enabled me to write very, very creatively. And I remember writing quite an intense poem about my son, you yes. know, and how it was because that relationship had been affected by me being ill.
Yes.
You know, so I think you're absolutely right there. I think that tapping into that creativity is, you know, it's certainly been the catalyst for your recovery. And I think there's a lot of people out there that, you know, just whatever it is, isn't it? You know, I was saying to you earlier that, you know, just I've started sewing again, and, yes. you know, whatever it is, something that just allows you to be, that isn't electronic, isn't the TV, and, you know.
Yes, something that allows you to be quiet and allows you to just completely, completely relax your mind. It's and sometimes something that's quite monotonous as well, you know, something that you can pick up and put down whenever you feel like it, that you don't need to plan sort of an hour in advance, you know, something that's very, very easy to engage with, I think is very important. There is actually a book that I would recommend, if that's of any help. It's a book called The Artist Way by Julia Cameron. And it was absolutely fantastic for me. And actually, after my wedding in 3 weeks, I'm planning in the new year to actually sit down and do this again, because it's a 12-week course that you can do at home. So it's basically a book that provides a 12-week course that guides you through the process of recovering your creative self. And it allows you, it basically shows you and helps you to bring creativity into your daily life, which I think is very important, and eventually discover, you know, your hidden talents, and whatever they are, because we all have them. Every single one of us have them. Whether we want to use them as a career is a completely different thing, but we all have them, definitely. So The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron is something that was very, very powerful. And what I love is that you can, from the beauty and comfort of your own home, work through this program at your own leisure. So I think that's definitely something that I would recommend.
Well, that's great.
Yes.
Any other top tips that pop into your head? Anything else that you'd advise somebody to do? I know. Oh, one thing we haven't mentioned is that you love Ayurveda, don't you? That's been something that you've used a lot in your recovery.
Yes, it is. Ayurveda is basically its alternative healing system. It actually is a Sanskrit word which means science or wisdom of life, and it's a very ancient philosophy based on the deepest understanding of the human body. It originated in the East thousands of years ago, but it is probably the most powerful thing I've ever done in my life. It's absolutely fantastic. I see an Ayurvedic doctor every month, and I take different herbs every day, and it's just absolutely fantastic, absolutely fantastic. I mean, like every sort of alternative therapy, not everything is going to be everyone's cup of tea or indeed work for everybody, but it's definitely something that is starting to be proven to be absolutely fabulous. You know, I mean, it's so ironic that it originated so many thousands of years ago, but actually now in our Western society, I feel that it's the way forward. I mean, for me, it's been absolutely incredible. I didn't realise that I could feel this much better, put it like that.
Well, just want to thank you so much for sharing all your experiences, and it's really, really been inspirational for people to hear how you've come through, all the things you've tried, because we know this is a combination lock that's unique to each of us.
Yes.
So that's why, you know, we're training chrysalis effect practitioners all the time, so that they can have that go-to person like you had, that can, you know, really empathise and take them through, and also integrate those therapies that's going to be right for that person. So yes. It's just been lovely to hear you talk about your journey, and we just wish you so well for this beautiful wedding. Can't wait to see the photographs.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I'm very excited about it.
So thank you very much, Natasha. Hopefully we'll speak again soon.
Yes. Take care, Elaine. Thank you so much. Lots of love.